Love talking to this guy, Assistant Professor Geology, Harvey Henson, Assistant Professor. First off, Harvey, morning. I hope you've been well.
Good morning, Tom. I am well.
You know,
thank you for having me on.
Like I said, I'm really excited when I get the opportunity to speak with you. And now we've got something with a little bit of traction to talk about. So anytime I've got that occasion, I love getting you on the air. Two big earthquakes. I lost count at 5,000 aftershocks in California. What's your takeaway from that event and its relevancy to us, in especially in light of the proximity of the New Madrid and other faults here in southern Illinois?
Yeah, well, this is a reminder that earthquakes happen all over. They happen quite frequently along the plate boundaries out in California and other places. But here in the Midwest, not so often, right?
All right, so your takeaway is this is a good opportunity to say, okay, you've gotten a reminder they can happen anywhere. Are you prepared?
That's right. Anywhere, anytime. Here in the Midwest, we get a major earthquake, you know, magnitude 5, 5.4, every 18 to 20 years, it seems like, you know, and you don't have to look back too far. 2008, and that was April 18th, right? Early Friday morning when we had a 5.4 that hit this area.
Right, I remember it vividly. I was still laying in bed because I was a bit of a bum before I started the morning show and thought, who just slammed the door to my bedroom? That was one of those reactions. And you know, it's interesting because you take a look at your number and say, look, California saw a 7.1 and a 6.4 within just, you know, a couple of days.
Right. And as you mentioned, they've had thousands of foreshocks and aftershocks. I think the count's almost 1,300 magnitude 2.5 and above earthquakes, you know, and that seems to be the threshold that people feel an earthquake, a 2.5 or larger. But instrumentally, yeah, they've had much more than that recorded.
Now, there has been kind of an argument from me being the novice that I am outside looking in as to what this means. Some geologists and experts when it comes to earthquakes believe this is healthy. When you see a bunch of these earthquakes, it's letting pressure off and means that you'll be averting the big one by having a lot of little ones, while others believe that these are precursors towards major earthquakes. You have a school of thought that you subscribe to?
Well, mathematically, it's an exponential phenomenon, meaning that when we go up in one order of magnitude, the amount of energy that's released is about 30-fold. And the amplification of that energy, that is the surface waves, the disruptions, is about a 10-fold phenomenon. So it takes 10 magnitude 6.0 earthquakes to equal one 7.0.
Right.
And then, you know, when we talk about the Great New Madrid earthquakes, because, and I hope we get a chance to do that, this area has a very interesting prehistoric and historic earthquake history. Those great earthquakes were approaching magnitude 8, according to some accounts.
Good, because I do have that on my list. But let's take a look at this issue of magnitude. Because, you know, Professor Henson just touched on this, that we had a lot of math to look at and occurrences and things to correlate. They said after, you know, the first earthquake, they were talking about within 10 days, there's an 11% chance of there being a big one, or the big one, as it's referred to out in California. And there was another set of statistics that said with the proximity of this, 70% chance of the big one by 2030 in San Francisco, and the big one was defined as 6.7. There are a lot of people that are attempting to forecast this and take that past math and apply it so we see some type of probability and so we see preparedness on not only but a government but also a personal level. We've got a lot of math that leads you to believe there's something behind this, right?
Right. You know, a big part of what scientists do or try to do is to look at patterns in the data, looking to find opportunities to make sense of what's going on. I'm going to leave those probabilities, those statistics, especially the forecasting, to the experts and others in the California region. And, you know, some of the colleagues in the United States Geologic Survey and other researchers, we have some probabilities for the central United States as well. Maybe we can chat about that.
Good. Let's do that, because here's the thing. I have a tendency to gravitate towards worst-case scenarios. It's just my nature, I guess. And so I'm watching social media, and somebody posts a picture of their pool in California during the earthquake. And the water is coming up 2 and 3 feet over the top of the pool edge, from a calm state to where it's literally jumping out of the pool. All right. Matter of fact, you and I talked about this, and I'd seen some videos from overseas of an earthquake, and it was shot literally right down the street, filled with people walking, and you can see how profoundly it affects a human being when the earth starts to move. But let's take a look at this water aspect and the New Madrid Fault. Let's hypothetically say we have a flood on the Mississippi River. Let's say that we have a 6-point earthquake, and it causes that water in the river to do the same thing that happened in that pool, except this time it's not the edge of a concrete pool, it's a levee.
Mm-hmm.
What happens?
Right. When these surface waves attempt to move water particles, soil particles, and or the combination of soil and water, we can talk about liquefaction and that phenomenon. Strange things happen. It's bewildering. But think of this energy as propagating great distances for these large earthquakes across the surface, below the surface, and these particles have to move, right? And the way they move is essentially they attempt to move as a wave front of energy expanding out away from the epicenter, away from the subsurface focus of the earthquake where it originated. That energy has to go somewhere. And you see it on the surface very dramatically in the videos that we've seen from California. You could expect large bodies of water and small backyard pools to respond to that surface wave propagating through it.
7 pounds a gallon. That's the way I look at it. You start throwing the river around at 7 pounds a gallon, and it'll take a levee and where it is connected to the earth and will literally push it off the top of the earth, and it'll be gone. And that liquefaction is a fascinating thing, and I had this on my list. I'm glad you brought it up as well, because that's particularly pertinent to Southern Illinois. If you take your two hands and make small miniature bowls out in front of your face and connect the your palms together, you have Southern Illinois. And what happens is in that area between your fingers, that is water, that's soil, excuse me, that is built up from the Ohio and Mississippi River. We live on the drumhead of a bowl of dirt here in Southern Illinois. And as Professor Henson talked about liquefaction, that means we live on a drumhead where that entire bowl could basically, with a level of shake, turn into a solid fluid, we'll call it, for lack of a better word. What's the correct term?
Yeah, liquefaction is what we're talking about. And you bring up a good point. When you look at the central United States, we grew up historically and even prehistorically along the river valleys, these great rivers in the Midwest, the Ohio and Mississippi and Missouri and the Wabash and Tennessee and other rivers in the area. The cities, the infrastructure, it's all tied to these river valleys. The large cities, look at the map distribution. They're all along the large rivers. And the prehistoric evidence for this earthquake activity in the Midwest, the historic activity that we know about, is evidence in many ways. But one of the most significant ways that we can find the historic events in the geologic record is by mapping out these liquefaction features, areas where the soil layers are ruptured because of the violent waves we've been talking about. And the liquefied soil, the aquifers, containing all this important groundwater, right, which we need, erupts with sand and other sediment up to the surface. And the surface is liquefied during these great earthquake events. You know, we're talking about magnitude 6 to magnitude 8 events that have been documented in the prehistoric and historic record.
Kind of like a milkshake. It looks solid, but it's not.
Right. You know, a term that our listeners may be familiar with is quicksand, right? So you can't support the weight of an object or a building if the sand and water or soil are liquefied and acting like quicksand during the shaking.
And we have two fault lines that could promote that. New Madrid is not the only fault line, although the most notorious. It is not. We live in an earthquake zone.
Right. There are two large seismic zones that most people are familiar with in this area, the New Madrid seismic zone, down in the Missouri Boot Hill along the Mississippi River Valley, extending up toward Cairo, Illinois, and then the Wabash Valley seismic zone, which is up between Indiana and Illinois and northern Kentucky and the Wabash River Valley. But there's actually a third. There's a northwestern extension from southern Illinois up toward St. Louis, again, predominantly along the Mississippi River Valley, called the St. Genevieve seismic zone. So southern Illinois, right where you and I are right now talking to our listeners, is in the middle of all three of these seismic zones.
Literally the epicenter of multiple zones. And it's kind of interesting, Harvey, these earthquakes in California, they happened on unknown fault lines. That surprised me.
Right. Southern Illinois, the central U.S. seismic phenomenon is enigmatic, and we could talk all day long about that. But these California earthquakes are happening along large strike-slip fault systems, some of them that haven't ruptured for a long time and some that are still waiting to rupture the surface. But that strike-slip fault systems that are out there, multiple fault systems, including San Andreas, are along a major plate boundary between the Pacific plate and moving generally toward the northwest, and the North American plate that comes right down through California and Baja, Mexico, moving more in a southern direction.
It's interesting, Harvey. I'm watching PBS, I think it is Monday night. I know I'm doing the interview with you, and the guy has an atlas made in Germany, a very rare book, 1736, I think. And it shows California as an island.
I've seen that, yeah.
You saw that too, and I'm thinking, you know, either they knew something we didn't, and granted, at that time they thought there was a river and California was an island, we just didn't know any better. But of course, after this week, you keep thinking maybe they knew something we didn't. But I thought that was an interesting reference. Now, and this is really almost all theoretical at this point. I've read several people's work that seems to indicate that a planet that has earthquakes, that has volcanoes, is a healthy planet. A planet that does not is an unhealthy planet, that the minerals, there's an exchange that goes on, that if you become tectonically locked, your planet becomes hot and becomes unlivable. I mean, and I know this is astrophysics work, but are earthquakes a sign of a healthy planet?
Well, that's an interesting point. I would say that it certainly is a sign that the Earth is dynamic, that it's changing, that, you know, it's evolving geologically. We think of the rock cycle as something very static, something that's not complicated at all. But when you look at a global version of the rock cycle, or we'll say the Earth's system that we call the lithosphere and the rock cycle on a large scale, earthquakes, volcanoes, plates moving at the rate your fingernails grow, you know, very slowly over time, it represents a living or a geologically living or dynamic Earth system.
Yeah.
And there are many things tied to that, right? We don't have a water cycle if we don't have mountains forming and volcanoes erupting and large ocean basins opening up between the continents because of tectonic processes over time.
And without a volcano, you don't have, right? Yeah, and if you don't have a volcano, you don't have Hawaii.
There you go. We don't have an atmosphere, and we don't have tremendous ecosystems. So the biosphere, the biological part of the Earth system, is all intricately tied to the lithosphere and the geologic cycles that we're talking about. So yeah, earthquakes are here to stay for this dynamic Earth that we live on the surface of.
And if they don't, then we're in trouble. You know, it's interesting. I often think about this. You like deviled eggs? You like deviled eggs? You ever boil egg?
I can eat them, sure.
I always think about that when I've got a boiled egg in my hand and there's a small membrane underneath it, and it can be really pesky because of the suction in the water, that those shells attach and move and push other things around on the shell. And I've always kind of thought that that was a good analogy for tectonics because that plate is physically so small, it's hard to imagine with me saying something that big is small, but it really is when you take a look at the dimensions of the planet and that you can push it and that membrane kind of, because those actions are together, and they've been talking about this too, saying, look, fault lines are really not so much as a single line as they are a network of lines. You just refer to that.
Yeah, that's a real good illustration. A boiled egg has the layers. The outer layer, the shell, is very thin, but very important, right?
Yeah.
And it's hard, it's brittle. Yeah, that's a good illustration. I think a lot of our educator partners use that, and also, you know, fruit, because of an apple, the skin on an apple is very thin compared to everything else.
So what do you what do you think about when it comes to numbers in New Madrid and applying math to it and the proximity of the big one or a damaging earthquake? What are your thoughts on that? And we all understand that this is some part conjecture, some part math. But, I mean, when you apply yourself to this, what are your concerns?
Right. So the United States Geologic Survey has put out sort of a statistical or a probability of repeat of large earthquakes in this region. And this is for the New Madrid seismic zone predominantly. And they're saying that the chance of a repeat of a great 1811, 1812 earthquake, right? These are the earthquakes that were somewhere around 7.5 in magnitude, you know, maybe a little more for some of those earthquakes. Those repeating in the next 50 years is about a 7 to 10% chance that one of those might happen again. And for a magnitude 6 earthquake or larger, the probability of one of those happening in the next 50 years is around 25 to maybe 40%.
Wow.
Likely. So that's what they're putting out. You know, we probably should talk about, for some of our listeners, what happened in 1811, 1812. What are the earthquakes they're talking about, magnitude 7.5 or larger?
And it's interesting you bring that up because some of the stories are so dramatic, you can't help but wonder if it was more densely populated what we would hear. But I've always been fascinated by the story of the Mississippi River flowing backwards. I've always thought that that was so pronounced. And the fact that they said after that earthquake, the earth was still ringing for basically 100 years afterwards. I mean, that is some moving stuff when you start thinking about it.
It's hard to imagine the amount of energy, the force that's released by a magnitude 7 or 7.5, right? I mean, that most geologists agree that those earthquakes in 1811, 1812, between December and February that winter, were around, you know, the greatest were around magnitude 7.5, two of those happening on December 16th. The amount of energy released during one of those earthquakes, right? Even if it's out in the middle of the Mojave Desert, we can see how much damage occurs and how widely felt the area is. Multiply that area felt by the Ridgecrest earthquake a couple of days ago. Multiply that by about 20. And the landmass, the size of the central United States all the way over to the eastern coast of the U.S. and the Gulf Coast, would feel intensely the shaking from a magnitude 7 event. We had four of those, Tom, in 1811, 1812. Two on December 16th, another repeat on January 23rd, and then a fourth one on February 7th. And like you said, eyewitness reports, the area wasn't widely populated. There were a few steamboats starting to go up and down the Mississippi River. So we have lots of eyewitness reports. There were a few river towns, you know, greater St. Louis area was maybe 5,000 people compared to, what, 1.5 million or more today. New Madrid, the town of New Madrid, was completely wiped out on February 7th because of liquefaction, because of, as you mentioned, the Mississippi River changed course and actually flowed backwards for a while before eventually rerouting and devastating the area.
So the idea that the bedrock lifted up enough to push the river upstream, is that what we're talking about?
That's what happened, right.
Like I said, and then they were saying, you know, even just a few years ago, the earth is still ringing from those series of earthquakes, that it's a bell that crust that we just talked about, the egg shell is still ringing, that there was so much energy imparted into it.
Right. As I said before, the earthquakes in the central U.S. are enigmatic. We don't have all the answers, right? And that's the beauty of science. There's a lot more work to be done. We need more scientists to come to a university here at SIU and study this problem. But we still record earthquakes almost on a weekly basis. We instrumentally can detect these vibrations you're talking about.
And every day, it's 8:43. I've taken so much of your time, but I appreciate every minute of it, Harvey. I really do. Preparation. You know, I literally, and I now have my go bag next to the front door right now with, you know, MRE, medical kit, batteries for backup cell phones. You might want to consider something like that, too. What do you got in your bag, Harvey?
I have some similar go bags at the office and at home. We put together, Tom, some colleagues of mine, Scott Hodson from Oklahoma University out in Norman, Oklahoma. We've put together some multimedia, some DVDs, and kiosk with the support of the Illinois Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, and then the Central United States Earthquake Consortium. We'll give them some credit here. We worked together to help, get the word out about the threat to the Midwest. And with the kiosk and the multimedia, we show people how to put together kits at home, at school, and for the office. And you can find one of these kiosks right now at the Science Center, the University
Good.
Mall here in Carbondale. Or you can contact me at the university, and I'll send you out a DVD if you're listening. I'd love for your classroom to maybe host us or invite us to come visit and talk to the students about earthquake safety and kits as well.
Yeah, I got a dog.
I think the more kits, the better, right?
Right.